It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, trash, don't pick it up, take them lights away. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkebaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So, in our last podcast, we talked about the problem of radioactive waste.
And how it's a pretty serious one. It's one that we have to lend serious consideration to so that we can find a solution that doesn't, irradiate people unnecessarily. Or even necessarily.
We talked about some of the waste facilities that are currently in existence and the main kind that we would really like to have that is currently not in existence.
Yep.
So today I figured we'd take a little more forward-looking look.
On a show called Forward Thinking?
Maybe a little more a forward-glancing look.
Okay.
A forward-looking glance.
But how about we just sort of explore the different options that may or may not be open to us as far as dealing with nuclear waste?
Right. Well, let's do a little bit of recap on the last episode. So
sure.
One of the things we learned is that not all nuclear waste is the same.
Exactly.
So the vast majority of the nuclear waste that is produced, or radioactive waste, is what's called low-level waste or intermediate-level waste.
And this is about 97% of all nuclear waste generated, but only 5% of the radioactivity.
Right. So what is this stuff?
Well, it's stuff that's been in contact with radioactive material and has picked up some radioactivity because of that. Either it's radioactive dust or the radioactive material itself has started to cause some ionizing reactions. So intermediate level waste tends to be stuff that's been in contact with radioactive waste for a while, like filters, parts of a reactor, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that probably also stuff like filings from uranium mills would fall into that generalized
probably
category.
Yeah. This gets kind of weird because different countries classify things in slightly different ways, but then low-level waste would include stuff that's had less intense contact with radioactive material, but still has come into contact with it. So tools, protective clothing and gear, that kind of thing, that might fall into that category. And we have to find ways to deal with all of it.
Yeah, these lower level wastes, they are still somewhat radioactive. So we do have to be careful in how we're dealing with them.
And, yeah, you don't want your children to swallow them.
Right, right. Yeah. So disposal. Right.
Take that protective over, you know, protective apron out of your mouth, Jimmy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, some gloves are more delicious than others.
I guess so.
Anyway, the low-level waste is not all that dangerous.
Yeah,
it's not good, but it's not something, it's not our main concern.
It's the sort of stuff that we can safely dispose of in a essentially a trench or pit and covered with soil, and it will be secure enough where we don't have to worry about that affecting people.
Yeah. I guess the intermediate level waste is intermediate, but what comes after intermediate?
High level waste.
That is what is a big problem.
Yeah. We're not talking about pants.
No.
That's not a high level waste.
It's not an 80s jeans kind of thing.
No, we're talking about waste that is highly radioactive. This is the stuff that makes up 95% of the radioactivity, even though it's only 3% of the volume of waste.
Yeah, so for the purpose of this podcast, we might just say high-level waste to include all the things we're about to mention, but
yeah.
Some people make a distinction between spent nuclear fuel and what they then call high-level waste on top of that.
High-level waste being what has been processed out of spent fuel.
Yeah, so if you have spent fuel,
right.
Yeah, you have spent fuel, you do some reprocessing of it so you can recapture uranium and plutonium from that spent fuel
that have not been burned.
Yeah, cuz as it turns out, not very much of it gets consumed in these nuclear reactors. It doesn't take much for a nuclear rod, for example, to become inefficient, so it's no longer heating up water to the levels that we need it to. But there's still plenty of uranium and plutonium in there, and those are important resources. So if we're able to reprocess it, we can recapture that uranium and plutonium, but there's going to be some stuff left over that is not going to be useful for us, and it's really radioactive. That is high-level waste. So we're probably going to be using high-level waste to refer to both that and the spent nuclear fuel. Just keep in mind that there are other people and organizations that do differentiate between the two.
Yeah, they are different things. They're just, for the practical purpose, they're both very radioactive and
yes.
very dangerous.
Yes.
So,
all right. So we talked about in our last podcast, we mentioned Yucca Mountain in Nevada was going to be a geological repository, this place where we would be able to put spent nuclear fuel or high-level waste or both and have it safely locked away so that it could not hurt people for 10,000 years was really the idea.
Mm-hmm. And,
or longer.
Right. Yeah, and we mentioned these kind of off the cuff and mentioned them as, well, this is what is generally agreed upon to be the best idea. So why is that? What's going on with these things exactly?
So the reason why it's considered to be the best idea is because it has a whole lot of separation between us and nuclear waste. But let's talk about how many there actually are in existence, because that's a real sticking point, right?
That's right. There are zero currently in operation.
For high-level waste or for spent fuel.
Yeah. So why are these facilities, these deep geological repositories, ideal for high-level waste?
Well, I mean, again, it keeps it really far away from people. It's, you know, we're talking about a finding a place on Earth where we can bury this stuff, where you're not too worried about the geological features changing dramatically over the next 100,000 years. You want it to remain as stable as possible because you want it to contain that nuclear waste.
Right. So you don't want to put it in a place where there's going to be a lot of like earthquakes or volcanic activity.
Yeah. That both of those would be very bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to have any chance of, or you want to minimize the chances of any sort of breach. You want it to be safe. Like you don't want it to be in a really tropical region. You don't want there to be a lot of water present.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to find an arid or semi-arid kind of area where water is not as big a problem. You want to be able to isolate the chamber, wherever you're putting the stuff, the repository itself, from any water, whether it's runoff from rain or if it's a water that's underground. You want to make sure it's safe from all of that so it doesn't contaminate any of those water sources, which could then go on to enter into, you know, various ecosystems and contaminate them. That would be bad as well.
So you mentioned that there were zero in operation for high-level waste. Are there geological repositories for something else, maybe intermediate-level waste?
Yeah, there are three in operation for low and intermediate-level waste. They are found in Finland and Sweden, and there is one in operation for transuranic waste in the USA at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP.
We will be revisiting the WIP facility later on.
Yeah, we mentioned it in the last podcast, but just as a reminder, transuranic waste is one of those terms that is used in the United States, but not really widely used elsewhere. It's generally talking about waste elements with atomic numbers that are higher than uranium. It's a byproduct of nuclear research, weapons production, and power production. And it's mostly stuff like tools, residue, gear, and usually only contains a small amount of actually radioactive material. It's still dangerous, but it's not considered as dangerous as high-level waste. It was used for the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant because you didn't have to go whole hog into high-level waste in your pilot program. You know, you want to test the pilot program, but you don't want to throw everything at it right at once and then risk having a catastrophic failure with the worst stuff on the planet.
Okay, so what's the idea behind the pilot plant?
Well, it's a facility outside of Carlsbad, New Mexico. And it's meant to be a 10,000-year safe facility.
Uh-huh.
And we talked a little bit in the last episode about the kinds of things that those facilities include.
Right.
What I find really fascinating and kind of charming about the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant is that it furthermore features a number of magnets, radar reflectors, and 48 stone and concrete markers weighing 105 tons each that are carved with warnings in seven languages and human faces expressing horror.
Yeah.
In order to drive people away from this facility
for 10,000 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
The idea being that how can we protect, and we'll talk more about this later,
yeah.
But how can we protect future generations from something as dangerous as nuclear waste, knowing that in 10,000 years' time, think about the last 10,000 years. I mean, we don't have any languages that date from that far back. So how would we even know how people are communicating within 10,000 years? One of those languages that was mentioned was Navajo,
right?
Because that was the native language of the area, which I thought was very interesting that was one of the represented languages on these markers. So yeah, very interesting. And again, we'll revisit that because there's some fascinating things to talk about in that respect. On top of that, this year, 2014, there were some incidents early this year at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. One of those was that there was an incident on February 14th, 2014, so Valentine's Day. There was a radiation leak underground. Within a couple of weeks, there was detection of airborne radioactive particles within a half mile from the facility, and ultimately, or at least initially, 13 workers were tested positive as having radiation exposure, which is, I mean, that's serious stuff, obviously. You're talking about a facility designed to contain this stuff, and there was a containment failure. One of the reasons why this is a really serious issue is that if you listen to our last episode, you heard us talk about the Yucca Mountain Project and how political pressures have really set that back to the point where it may not ever be used for what it was intended. There were some people who were saying we should probably look at WIP as instead the next geological repository and upgrade it so that we could put high-level waste there, because now we've got this pilot program. But with this radiation leak, that really brings that into question too. Like, is it a good idea when we're talking about a low-level or intermediary-level type of radiation having a leakage problem? What happens when we put the high-level stuff there? If there was a leakage problem with that, it could be even more serious.
Right.
I mean, any radiation leakage problem is serious already. But when you're talking about...
it could be more catastrophic.
Exactly.
Level.
Yeah, you could have some truly devastating effects, especially if that radiation gets leaked into the surrounding ecosystem. So that's kind of leads into the same discussion we had last time. The political issues are huge. Like, one, you have to figure out where on Earth are the prime real estate places for these kind of things, right?
Well, that's not so much a political issue. That's sort of a scientific issue.
No, but that's the first problem you have.
Yeah,
it's like, let's just identify where, like, we can't put these anywhere. We have to put them someplace that is geologically ideal for a repository. That's problem one.
Yeah, and even Yucca Mountain had some problems with that. I mean, people were arguing that it was too close to fault lines, and
there were people who were arguing there was too much tectonic activity. There were people who were arguing that there were too many cracks in the rock itself,
that was picked of 9 potential facilities as the absolute best one.
Right.
So nothing is probably going to be absolutely perfect.
Right. And so first you have to pick the places that you could potentially put this stuff. Then you have to convince people that that's what needs to go there. And if you live near those places, like we mentioned in the last episode, you might have that not in my backyard reaction where you do not want this dangerous stuff put near you. And it's a very human and understandable reaction. It's also one that's problematic because then what do you do with all the stuff that's accumulating? So, these are really big issues. There's also just the question of how do you get the nuclear waste from where it's generated to where it's supposed to go, right?
Yeah, it opens up the possibility of having a nuclear waste transportation accident. There's actually a debate going on in Scotland right now about whether local plants should be allowed to consolidate waste prior to permanent disposal.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's no one likes car accidents. No one really likes plutonium involved car accidents.
Right. Yeah. Doc Brown told us that that's a bad idea.
Fortunately, as far as I know, I don't think there's ever been a radioactive waste transportation accident.
No.
They have them pretty well locked down.
Yeah.
It's an extremely expensive and paperwork filled process.
Yeah. It's actually one of those where, obviously if you're going to be transporting something like that, you have to do it in a way that is incredibly well coordinated and extremely secret, because you don't want to publicize when this dangerous stuff is going to be out in the open,
right,
from one site to another.
Dinner bell for potential nuclear weapons makers.
Yeah, exactly. So it's certainly one of those things that is a high priority activity whenever it does happen.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about the technicalities involved in that later on.
Yeah. So let's, instead of looking at this, so that the repository was sort of the big solution that people settled on a couple of decades ago, is saying, all right, this one sounds like this is the best idea. And as it turns out, there are a lot of human problems that make it hard to implement this idea. But what about other ideas of how to deal with nuclear waste?
What about just cramming it in a garage somewhere?
Well, that's what we're doing right now. That, as it turns out, is not necessarily a long-term solution. And while I am being facetious by saying that's what we're doing right now, what we are doing right now is not that far from cramming it into a garage.
I mean, it's like a really nice garage.
It's a garage that was meant to hold nuclear waste, but not indefinitely. It was meant to hold it for,
like
30 decades.
Yeah, 30 years or so.
So, yeah, long-term above-ground storage, that was investigated by a lot of countries, including the United States, and was eventually said, this is not a good idea. It's just not safe enough. It's not... it's not a permanent solution. It's intermediate at best. So we need something else. In fact, the United States looked into it as being a potential long-term solution and then said, we got to find a different way. So that's off the table.
Okay. What about this idea of reprocessing? This has come up before, that apparently some countries reprocess spent nuclear fuel.
Yeah.
To see what they can do with it. Now, is this something that's going to get rid of the high-level waste problem?
Absolutely not. This is what generates high-level waste.
Okay, how does it do that?
So you got the spent nuclear fuel, and we mentioned before that when you use nuclear fuel, you only use up about 2% of it, especially in solid nuclear fuel. There are different types of reactors. Like, if you were using liquid nuclear fuel, it's a different thing. But your standard solid nuclear rod, you use up about 2% of the fuel, and the other 98% remains unburned, which means that, if you're just going to toss that, you're losing all that potential.
Throwing away a lot of, right.
Yeah. Now, the thing is that uranium is actually not that expensive compared to the process of reprocessing uranium. So if it's cheaper to buy new uranium than it is to reprocess the stuff you've already used, guess what people do? They buy new uranium because there's no incentive to reprocess the stuff you already have if it's more expensive than just going out and buying the new stuff. Now, around the late 2000s, the price of uranium started to climb, and that caused a lot of countries to look into this reprocessing technique, which means they tried to reclaim as much of the uranium and plutonium that still exist in that nuclear fuel as possible. And about 96% of it is uranium, and about another percent is plutonium, and the remaining 3% is this stuff they can't use. That's the high-level waste that we've been talking about. That's the stuff that's really dangerous, and it's going to be dangerous for a long, long time, so we got to figure out what to do. So even if you do reprocess it so that you can use the stuff again in some other nuclear fuel reaction, whatever that may be, you still, at the end of the day, have stuff left over that you have to figure out what are you going to do with it. So it's not a solution of getting rid of nuclear waste. It's just how do you keep on using the stuff you've got for as long as you can, rather than buying new uranium. So not a long-term solution.
And it doesn't completely solve the problem.
Not at all. No.
Yeah.
You still have the problem of the high-level waste, and eventually you're going to get to a point where it will cost more to reprocess whatever fuel you have than to just go out and get new stuff, unless you're somehow re-enriching it and recombining it with other reprocessed fuel. This is
so perhaps unless stuff. There were regulations that were forcing companies to do this, it might not be what anyone would choose to do.
Right. And ultimately, it's not a big environmental improvement over just storing spent nuclear fuel in pools, which is what we're doing right now. We're keeping them in pools for 50 years before we can do anything else with it.
Well, I have a different solution that involves putting nuclear waste in waters.
What's that?
It's called, quote, disposal at sea, a.k.a. dumping radioactive waste directly into the ocean.
Yeah, because it's not like there's anything going on in oceans. It's not like there are complex ecosystems or worldwide movements of large trade winds.
Right. Giant currents that could carry nuclear particles thousands of miles onto the shores of distance.
Okay, let's back off. Now, surely nobody would actually do this, right? One of those proposed solutions.
Clearly, this is crazy and no one would ever do it.
No, nobody except like a dozen different countries, including the United States, Russia, and the former Soviet Union, the UK, Japan, a bunch of other European countries. There are dump sites in the oceans all over the world. Now, here's the big thing to keep in mind. As far as we know, it's not like people have been dumping high-level waste into the ocean. This is a dump. They've been dumping intermediate and low-level waste into the ocean. Still, there were decades when this was done. Decades. If people began to get increasingly uncomfortable over time. So since the 1990s, international agreements have banned dumping radioactive waste into the ocean. But
so we've been doing this since what, like the 60s, the 50s?
I think since the 40s, maybe?
And it wasn't until the 90s that we all got it together to be offended by it?
We had a lot going on in the 80s. There was like a lot going on that you aren't aware of.
I mean, I was mostly...
Joe Piscopo was teaching America how to laugh on Saturday Night Live.
I believe
that's
you.
That's true. And the DVR didn't even exist yet, so you had to watch that.
Yeah.
It seems crazy to me. Even though this is... So we are talking about lower-level wastes.
But it's
not that incredibly dangerous high-level waste. If they were doing that, that would be absolutely insane.
Yeah.
This lower-level waste, supposedly, from what I've read, most authorities have said... It's probably not really dangerous. It's probably not significantly harming ecosystems because it's contained and it's the lower level waste.
And water is a very good shield against radiation.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have several. Yeah. You wouldn't want to get right next to any sort of radioactive source, even in the water. But 10 meters away, if there's 10 meters of water around this radioactive stuff, then it's a very good shielding unit for...
It's less of a problem than it would be 10 meters away in air.
Yes. So it's, there's that to consider as well. So depending upon the dumping site, there could be a minimal impact on certain ecosystems, but it's still something that I would be very much not happy with. Especially if I were like, I don't know, someone who actually came across one of these things. But that's never happened,
right? Speaking of that, I read in an article in the Wall Street Journal this wonderful paragraph. Quote, commercial fishermen have at times hauled up waste containers from various parts of the Massachusetts Bay, home to a dump site. Frank Mirarchi, a 70-year-old retired commercial fisherman, said his catches occasionally included nuclear junk containers. After one such discovery, Mr. Mirarchi said government officials checked him and his crew for radiation, but didn't find problems.
Comforting.
It's so once again, I do want to remind you, it's not like that they're dumping the high-level waste. It could be a lot worse.
And they're not dumping anything now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But just,
it's not like they were previously dumping the high-level waste, probably.
Well, yeah, as far as we know. I mean, honestly, I don't know what the Soviet Union was doing. But
I'm not sure even the Soviet Union was aware of what the Soviet Union was doing. That was part
of the problem.
Why it's the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, but in any case, so it's not like we've got high-level waste rolling around in the ocean as far as we know.
But still,
bad idea. Don't ever do that again, humans. Still, please dispose of this stuff properly.
And why that seems to be the wide agreement. You know, that nations around the world have said, you know what, you're right, our bad, we won't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So let's look at another alternative.
How about really, really deep holes in the ground? So when we talk about stuff like Yucca Mountain, there you're talking about going down like 1,000 feet.
That's
like
about 300 meters.
Yeah. 300 meters of rock. So the ideal thing about Yucca Mountain is that it was supposed to be like under 300 meters of rock, but also 300 meters above the water table.
Right.
Okay.
So it's not going to be leaking into the groundwater that you're going to pull up in your well, or that's going to get into the ecosystem, and it's going to be really far separated from the surface. But you could actually, if you weren't trying to hollow out a full facility with large storage spaces and stuff like that, you could probably go a lot deeper, right?
Sure. I think you're dancing around a borehole there.
A borehole indeed.
Yeah, where you bore a hole into the earth, which doesn't involve speaking like Ben Stein at the ground or anything. It actually involves drilling really, really far down.
Instead of like 300 meters or 1,000 feet, this would be in terms of kilometers deep.
Yeah.
So like maybe 2 to 5 kilometers below the surface.
Which is not unprecedented. We have drilled as far down as 6 kilometers for things like oil.
Yeah.
So if we were to identify appropriate areas where the strata were amenable to the kind of things we need to do, like dump nuclear waste down it, we could totally do that. You could, at least in theory, bore a hole really far down, lower the nuclear waste into it, sometimes depending upon the type of hole. We've seen estimates between 100 and 200 metric tons could fit in a single borehole.
And you're not just gonna plunk it in there? Like,
no,
just drop it.
No, lowering it would be the best thing.
I don't know. Maybe you just drop it. I don't know.
I don't think so. I would consider one of the big concerns, I'm jumping ahead here, but one of the big concerns is that what happens if nuclear waste were to get caught on the way down? Like, you're lowering containers in. You're not just pouring out green glowing sludge, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles style, into it. But you're lowering containers down, and if it were to get stuck on something on the way down, then it wouldn't be at the appropriate depth, the agreed-upon depth. Like, this is all based upon estimations of how long will this place remain safe, because we need a long-term solution.
Oh, yeah, and also, I mean, right, you're going to be dropping casks or lowering casks. It's all going to be very well protected, I'm sure, before it even gets to the borehole site.
Yeah, so you get down, you lower it down there, about 100 to 200 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel could go down there. The U.S. generates at least 2,000 metric tons of this a year.
Yeah, so the Nuclear Energy Institute estimates that we produce between about 2,000 and 2,300 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel per year. But that is just the spent nuclear fuel. That is not all of the high-level waste.
Right. And then, when you're talking about high-level waste, you're talking more like 7,000 metric tons per year. So anyway, for just the spent nuclear fuel, you would need 10 to 20 boreholes every year to meet that demand. So you'd have to dig between 10 and 20 every single year to do this.
Kilometers down.
And then for the high-level waste, you're talking 35 to 70 additional ones to handle all that stuff. And there are some big concerns. Like I said, what happens if it gets stuck on the way down? It's not the right depth, then that's a problem. How do you unstick it safely so that you can lower it all the way to the base? Another is that you have to develop an appropriate seal for the top of this borehole so that it is sealed properly. It's not going to let any particulates out, and it's not going to easily let anyone else into it, mm-hmm. whether on accident or by design. You have to make sure that the well casing is really strong so that it can withstand any kind of shifting. I mean, obviously, the ground does tend to shift every now and again. You don't want to put these anywhere close to an area that has a lot of earthquake activity or any earthquake activity.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be really careful about groundwater again, knowing that any sort of high-level waste that's generating heat could cause groundwater to start to swell out of the ground. That's a big issue because that's going to alter an ecosystem. Even if there's no radiation leakage, mm-hmm. it changes the ecosystem itself. So one of the other issues with boreholes is that theoretically, if you were to use a geological repository, you could design it in such a way that should we come up with a technology where spent nuclear fuel would be a great resource to have, you could go and retrieve it. Not so much with boreholes.
Nope.
Yeah, so that would be another potential downside. Now, granted, this is saying it's a potential downside in the future, which may or may not ever come up with a great way to use spent nuclear fuel. So you're like, well, okay, but that doesn't solve the problem we have right now.
Yeah, we don't as a global population want to be that person who just hoards craft materials that they might never use again, except those craft materials could totally kill you.
Yeah, right. Have the world's most dangerous junk drawer. Yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Okay, but surely there are other wonderful ways we could cram nuclear waste into the Earth's crust.
There are other ways. And don't call me Shirley. I'm so sorry. Okay, how about rock melting?
Rock melting.
Yeah, it sounds like a B-52 song, but it totally isn't.
Rock
melting. Yeah. awesome. Fantastic.
I'm not participating in this.
So the idea is to melt wastes into adjacent rock to create eventually a solid mass that is radioactively stable. So think of it this way. You've got these casks of radioactive material that heat up pretty hot, you know, especially if you've got a whole bunch of them together, and you put them in an area where they're surrounded by rocks. They eventually heat the rocks up to molten status, and the rocks end up being this gooey thing all around them. You got molten radioactive lava, essentially, but as it cools, it solidifies, and that radioactive material would, in theory, be fairly uniformly dispersed throughout that solid mass. So instead of this concentrated radioactive source, you have a more dispersed radioactive source that isn't as dangerous over time. And it's also, again, deep underground when you do this. You don't just pour it out over rocks on the ground.
That also somehow sounds like it'd be less likely to get back out, like if it's incorporated into the rock structure.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to get back at this stuff easily in a way that it's a way where if you were to use this method, you're not going to be using that for fuel again anytime in the foreseeable future. Russian scientists even proposed digging a deep borehole and then putting plutonium in it and then immobilizing it through the sound use of nuclear explosions.
Oh,
finally.
Yeah.
A way to put Tsar Bomba under the earth.
No, but after much discussion, it turns out they thought this was a crazy idea because who knows what it could do to the surrounding environment and water table if you were to detonate a nuclear reaction just to immobilize some nuclear waste underground. So it was considered eventually to be what they call a bad idea and didn't pursue it.
Well, I've got a bad idea that might be even worse. What if you did pretty much the same thing, but with ice instead of rock?
Ah, so you put a big old hot container of radioactive sludge on top of an ice sheet and just let it melt straight into
like a
ice cube.
Glacier or something? Like those things that were already having a huge problem with melting all the time?
Yeah, it becomes Encino Man. And about as bad to let out of the ice.
To be fair, a lot of these discussions of using ice sheets happened before we had some major, major problems with ice sheets receding. So, or at least before they became as noticeable as they are now. The idea was that you would put these things on the ice, they would melt a hole through and just start boring down into the ice sheet, and then eventually the ice would reform on top of that hole, so you would have a nice solid barrier of ice all around this radioactive material. And as we've discussed, water is really good at shielding from radiation. But yeah, international treaties pretty much mean that is off the table. For one thing, most countries wouldn't have access to this directly. They'd have to treaty with some other country that does have access to it and be able, you know, to dump their nuclear waste in another country. That's not likely to happen. Countries don't tend to be too hot on the idea of, bring us all the stuff that you're afraid is going to kill you and we'll totally hold on to it for you.
And even if you found a country neutral place, I mean, isn't Antarctica a scientific
place.
We could just scrap all of the scientific endeavors going on down there.
Yeah, there's some treaties that prevent us from doing that.
Okay.
Yeah, but same sort of idea. The idea that, you know, we could, in theory, put it there, except for the fact that most countries have signed treaties saying we totally won't do that because we all agree that that's probably not the best idea.
It's not the best use of the area.
No.
Yeah.
No, just the fact that it's for public use. That's kind of like saying, because we can't dump trash in our front yard, maybe we should just go dump it in the street.
Yeah, or really it's in the yards of those other people over there because they moved away and who knows, who cares? Let's just put it all in that vacant lot.
Okay. Well, I think, what about a better idea? Now, we have talked before, we won't really focus on it today because we've done a whole podcast on it before, but the idea of like thorium reactors and waste reclaiming nuclear reactors, there are certain proposals for types of nuclear energy that could use up some of this stuff that currently becomes waste.
Which I think is a brilliant idea if we can make it practical.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you can make it where, again, you're getting more energy out of the deal than it took to make the deal possible, even if that's a long-term prospect, then that's something we should look into.
What about this idea of remediation?
Well, remediation is one of those fields that scientists, researchers are looking into as a possible way of dealing with nuclear waste, including using stuff like microbes or metal sulfides, transmutation methods, bringing old alchemy into the nuclear age.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea is just to decrease the radioactivity of nuclear waste. But the thing is, we don't know if any of those methods are ever going to be scalable, if we'll ever be able to deal with more than just minute traces. It may be that in the lab, sure, this method works great for this tiny amount of radioactive material. But if you're talking about the material produced by an entire nuclear plant over the course of a year, there may not be any practical way of using these methods to deal with that amount of waste. And even if it's practical, it may not, in the sense of it works, it may not be practical from an energy or monetary source. If it costs more energy for you to do that
again,
than some other method, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I think what all of this is leading up to is the basic fact that we don't even want this on our planet. This is not, there is no good place that is entirely safe for us to put nuclear waste.
Not that we can access anyway, right?
Right. Well, I guess we could put it into the core, but you can't really get there.
Yeah. If there was only like a little hatch straight to the core.
If we had some kind of Jules Verne style machine for that, then that would be terrific. But why don't we just shoot it into space, y'all?
This is the internet commenter's solution.
Shoot it into
space. Blast it, blow it out the airlock.
Same thing for trash, right? That was the same thing. It was like, why don't we just like get rid of the landfills by attaching it to like a giant net to a rocket, just aim that sucker at the sun and say sayonara, man.
Yeah. Does it make sense to shoot it into space? The answer is no.
It doesn't.
No.
Joe, pray tell, why does it not make sense?
Well, I just decided to gather a few basic facts and then do some depressing math.
And now we bring you the popular forward-thinking segment, Depressing Math.
Okay, so first of all, space launches are very, very expensive. So cost per pound is going to vary with every launch, and so different rockets will have different expenses. But the older, commonly cited figure is that on average, it costs NASA about $10,000 per pound to take cargo from the surface of the Earth to low Earth orbit.
Okay. Right?
So in the near future, that average might change. It's probably going to be different. We don't know exactly what the number is going to be. So maybe we imagine with the advent of private space launches, it'll get a lot lower. Suffice to say that it's still going to be a really high cost.
Right.
So take whatever lowball option you want. Let's say to have some contrast, maybe they'll cut it in half to $5,000 a pound. I think that might be very optimistic, but we don't know. So the nuclear industry produces about 2,000 to 2,300 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel per year, according to the Nuclear Energy Institute, and they are a nuclear industry lobbying group, so I think it's a good idea to suspect that these figures might be conservative.
And this is just for the United States, right?
Yes.
So 2,300 metric tons is about 5,070,000 pounds.
Okay.
Multiply that by $10,000 per pound, and it's $50.7 billion a year in launch costs.
And that's just launching. That's not counting the transportation of getting the waste to the launch site or what we do with it once it's in space.
Yeah, or even developing the right kind of capsule to carry the stuff in the first place.
Right. So if you want to be much more optimistic and assume the launch costs of $5,000 per pound, that's still $25.4 billion. And that's just the spent nuclear fuel.
Okay, well, what about high-level waste?
And so if you assume there you're talking about a number something like 7,000 metric tons a year, that's about 15.4 million pounds. So to ship that into space at 10,000 per pound, it'd be $154 billion a year. At 5,000, it'd be $77 billion every year. And keep in mind also, this is just the new spent nuclear fuel and high-level waste that we're producing every year, not counting all the stuff we've already got sitting there.
But Joe, can we afford not to shoot it into space?
I want to say one more thing. Hold on. That's also just talking about low Earth orbit. To send something farther away than low Earth orbit, like to, say, shoot it into the sun, as some people have imagined, which actually, if you're going to shoot it into space, that's probably one of the best places to send it. You don't really want to keep it in low Earth orbit.
No.
That's not
not
where
with the
you
potential
want.
For it to have orbit decay and fall right back to Earth.
Right. So you want to take it to the sun, like Superman did with nuclear weapons in Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, one of our favorite shows to reference.
Fantastic documentary.
Yeah, one of our favorite movies here. It would cost even more. I mean, a lot more.
A lot typically, more in fuel costs to get it out there.
Yeah, well, to take something to like to geosynchronous orbit costs a lot more than low Earth orbit.
Once you get out of the gravitational pull of Earth, you really just need a little thrust, and then it'll just go, you know.
Well,
that way,
the costs of rocket launches aren't just in the fuel. I mean, that's a lot of it, but a lot of it's got to be in designing this capsule and stuff like that. So the even more important issue is that even if we were to have unlimited money to blast this stuff into space, the bigger concern is what happens if there's a critical launch failure on a vehicle that is carrying high-level nuclear waste?
Yeah, the sad fact about the space industry is that it hasn't gone off without a hitch. There is a long history of failures, some catastrophic in nature, some where tragically people lost their lives as a result. And, you know, it's a fact that things that we build will not always work exactly as we had intended all the time.
Right. So it is a very horrible tragedy when there's a launch failure and astronauts lose their lives. It would be so much worse even to not only have astronauts lose their lives, but to have high-level nuclear waste raining down over the surface of the Earth from the atmosphere.
Right.
I mean, that's just a horrible scenario.
Mind-bogglingly bad.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, we talk about the not-in-my-backyard problem with the geological repositories. Can you imagine the reaction of people who live near launch sites if it were made public that we are going to attempt to launch nuclear waste into space? This place where tragedy has struck before could potentially become ground zero for high-level waste raining down everywhere.
And even if you could, you know, material science your way into a container that would absolutely be foolproof against that kind of thing, that's a container that you're talking about shooting into the sun. And I'm sure it's not inexpensive to crank out. So.
Yeah. It's not feasible for multiple reasons. It would be incredibly expensive. The risk would be astronomical, not to make too big of a space pun on it. And so it does not make sense. If we had a magical teleport device, sure, but we don't have one of those. So we have to deal with the problem here on Earth.
So I guess that's not to say that at no point in the future of humanity will it ever be feasible, but you just have to, it would take a lot to get there. It'd have to be much more economically feasible to take stuff to orbit. You'd have to have a very, very safe way of transporting cargo from the surface to orbit. And right now we have nothing like that.
All that being said, the United States did actually look into this as a potential way, not necessarily, throwing all their chips into it. They're just like, well, does this make sense?
Had somebody write up a report, I guess.
Yeah. There probably was just a big response that just said, nope.
So they didn't go with the idea.
No, they did not.
As a quick fix, something a little bit more down to earth has been proposed. And sorry, I'm sorry, I couldn't not.
No, that's great. That. Please.
Okay.
We're down proud of you.
Go right ahead.
Some people are proposing 250-year sites for storing this kind of waste.
Yeah, I think that's a much better idea.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and in response, some people have said, well, what about the real sites like Yucca Mountain? And I mean, okay, look, you guys, currently the yuccamountainproject.gov website is a timestamp.
Yeah, it literally just gives you the timestamp.
There's nothing there. Not even a few under-construction GIFs.
Yeah, you don't even have a looping MIDI of something playing in the background. Nothing.
Tired of waiting on you.
I think we should write them to their non-existent email address.
Okay.
And let them know about this.
We can do that. I'm sure that's high up on their list.
But the problems with these 250-year sites are that, I mean, basically they're only good for 250 years. That's not actually, that's really only delaying the problem for a very short period of time, globally speaking.
Sure.
And you're still incurring the expense of building these sites and transporting all of this waste over to them, which, as we mentioned before, is not really easy or simple. I mean, we do already do quite a bit of it. According to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, we already have some 3 million packages of radioactive materials being shipped by highway, rail, air, and water around the United States every year, which is a lot.
Yeah.
That seems like a whole bunch to me, especially considering that it's such an expensive-sounding process that involves all of this shipping materials testing, like every single container that is used has to be exposed to really stringent testing.
Sure.
And furthermore, a lot of interdepartmental handshakes and paperwork, and furthermore, like armed escorts in the case of spent fuel going through populated areas. All kinds of considerations are taken.
Now, I will say that I've seen some people propose that we go with the 250-year route, working toward making facilities that would be strong enough to go much longer than that.
Oh, but, like a rent-to-own option.
Yeah, the idea being that it's a lot easier to sell the idea of 250 years because you actually have to build in stuff like budget, right? You have to budget for a facility that can can withstand this for 250 years. If you design something that can actually last 10,000 years, but you sell it as 250 years, then suddenly you have something that's easier to work around when you're talking about numbers and spreadsheets and budgets. I know that sounds crazy. It sounds insane that it all comes down to moving some figures around on a spreadsheet to make sure that you can pay for the thing that you need. But ultimately, that's the reality we live in. So it is possible that just by reframing a repository as saying this is a 250-year solution rather than a 10,000-year solution, you make it a more likely reality that someone will be, all right, well, I can wrap my head around that. When you give me a number like 10,000 years, it's so long that my reaction is just immediately to go on the defensive. 250 years, although it's well beyond the expected lifespan of anyone living today, barring any miraculous discoveries in one form or another, I mean, singularity all aside, then it's something that's a little bit easier for us to comprehend.
It's envisionable.
Well, yeah, 10,000 years you're talking about, that's going into prehistoric time if we go 10,000 years back.
That's
right?
Like the beginning of agriculture, basically.
Yeah, I mean, but 250 years, then you're like, oh, okay. I know in general what people were like 250 years ago.
Yeah, 250 years in the future is just going to be like floating skateboards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, that's next year.
They won't technically be skateboards, will they?
No.
They'll be hoverboards.
Right.
Yeah. Coming to you next year.
Get your facts straight, Lauren.
Coming to you next year. I think October of next year, actually, according to Back to the Future 2.
Oh, nice.
Oh, right.
We'll have to look out for those. Okay, yeah. Okay. So I want to move the discussion on to one last consideration, which I think is actually one of the most interesting questions. Let's say that we don't have a solution that's one of these sort of reprocessing or remediation solutions, one of the things that takes the waste out of the picture. Assuming we have waste that's going to be here to stay, how do we talk to the future to keep it safe?
Right.
So we'll say that I think, would y'all agree that for now it seems like the standard answer, the deep geological repositories, probably are the best solution currently, more than all these alternatives?
I think out of all the ones that have been proposed, they make the most sense.
Okay, yeah, I would probably agree. So imagine you've got a facility that's a deep geological repository. It's a place where deep under the ground, there is a bunch of buried, very dangerous waste. And it's going to be dangerous long, long, long after you're gone, 10,000 years in the future, maybe even 100,000 years in the future.
Uh-huh.
How do you communicate that fact to the future? Actually, so one of my favorite other podcasts did a great episode about this. It's a podcast called 99% Invisible. And so if you're a fan of our show, you should also check them out.
Yeah.
They did an episode, I think it was called 10,000 Years, and they looked into exactly this problem in the episode, and I just really liked it a lot. I like them so much. I really think all you should go check it out, so I wanted to give them a shout-out. And they focused on the idea that at the place we talked about earlier, the waste isolation pilot plant, the WIP facility, there was a project to study exactly this problem of how to communicate the danger of a nuclear waste storage facility to people far, far in the future.
When you can't anticipate what sort of language they'll be using, how they'll be communicating.
Like, yeah.
How do you communicate something when you have no clue what those people are going to use as a basis for communication?
I mean, if you're talking to people 10,000 years in the future, you're basically talking to aliens.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no guarantee they'll speak any language that's on Earth today. There's no guarantee that they will share our cultural knowledge. So they might not even understand the same symbols we have today.
I like the part, and this was in the podcast. You definitely should listen to that episode because it was very informative and entertaining. I like the part where they talked about how people gravitate toward the skull and crossbones as a warning, saying, you know, that's like poison, danger, pirates, etc. Things that you don't necessarily want to encounter. Keep in mind, folks, not all pirates look like Johnny Depp. In fact, I think none of them did. So, you know, it's one of those things where you say, well, this is clearly going to be that kind of warning, except that if you look around today, you see lots of skull and crossbones on stuff like kids' toys.
Skateboards.
Yeah. My wife has a sweater with one that has a little pink bow on it. You know, these are things that
we have perhaps diluted its meaning, is what you're saying.
So in other words, we cannot count on a culture thinking of skull and crossbones as any kind of warning. They might think, oh, wow, this is where Hot Topic started.
One thing I thought about is that the nuclear symbol.
Yeah.
We expect that should continue to have meaning for all ages. Now, how many novelty items have you seen with the nuclear symbol on them?
We have perhaps diluted.
Coffee mugs, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So in this other podcast, they talk a lot about the signs and the symbols and how to communicate that in sort of these visual warnings. But I wanted to focus on something else the WIP project studied, which was trying to create landscapes that would themselves discourage people from coming near them.
Yeah.
So sort of this landscape engineering, what I would call stay awayscapes.
Right.
That seemed like a really interesting idea to me because that might rely less on people being able to understand the messages you're sending through text or through pictures.
So you're purposefully making the landscape foreboding and trying to communicate the idea of this is a bad place without knowing what the cultural ideas of good and bad are going to be in 10,000 years. Just try and make it so that any reasonable person would look at that and say, yeah, not going there.
Yeah, so let's just put ourselves in the space and try to imagine what you would have to do. So you've got an area of land and you need to put things there and they're going to have a lot of qualities. Like one of the qualities those items you put in the place need to have is that they make the message clear. Like they say, stay away very clearly.
They have to be able to last as long as the facility is going to last.
Exactly. And if that's going to be 10,000 years or even 100,000 years, I mean, what on earth? They can't
really sturdy, like impossibly sturdy material.
Right.
They have to be something that's not going to be blown away by the wind or.
Joe, let's just look around at all the stuff humans have built that have lasted for 10,000.
I mean, not much. Maybe some ancient megalithic structure. Is it Malta, I guess? I mean, not 10,000. But
no, when you're going 10,000, you're kind of looking at caves.
It has to be able to withstand the natural kind of removal and recycling process of the Earth.
So erosion and all that kind of stuff.
So a lot of the ideas that have been floated you might understand why their ideas for like gigantic stone monuments and stuff
like that. Right.
Yeah. I can't think of ever a time in my life where I saw some sort of gigantic structure and thought, oh gosh, I totally don't want to get closer and see what the heck that thing is.
That's exactly the next problem. You have to actually make sure that this thing is not attractive.
Yeah.
So like one of the ideas they mention is this landscape of thorns. Did y'all see the pictures on the website?
Yeah, the pictures just made me think there's no way I would not want to go there.
Yeah. the idea behind it. So it was designed by one of the people this project contacted. They had this idea that you should have these scary looking spikes jutting up out of the earth to communicate a sense of danger and foreboding, to make it look like a really scary place, you know, the Valley of Thorns in a Disney movie.
It looked to me like the landscape you would see in a Tim Burton film before he took a heat lamp to it and it formed all the little curlicues.
Yeah.
So
pretty much. Anyway, what it looked to me was like something that would make me think, man, I got to go check that out.
That looks like a playground. I want to go to there.
Exactly. Right. It's when you make things that are intentionally designed to look scary, they actually end up looking too interesting.
Yeah, there's an aesthetic quality to that.
Yeah, you'd have to figure out some way of making it less interesting. So maybe you make the most boring place.
Right.
No one would want to go there.
Also, what are these design elements created from? Because there's the potential of people going like, this looks like a terrific recycling field.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly right. So you don't want to make them out of anything that can be repurposed, because people might show up in 10,000 years, whatever, and say, hey, you know, that's a bunch of steel. I can make buildings out of steel.
Right.
Let me get some of this and might as well build a building next to this place. So this creates a really difficult problem. How do you achieve all of these different ideas? I mean, one idea I thought about was, instead of having any kind of like spikes or interesting jutting features, would be to kind of try to create the most unfriendly but uninteresting landscape possible. So maybe just this landscape of really unclimbable rock rubble. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
I suppose so.
With a barrier around it, I think it's really the barrier around it. If you have a whole lot of, at a safe distance, a whole lot of big blocks that have, you know, human faces contorted in horror.
Yeah.
But yet again, I would think that was interesting. And one thing you might notice is, so lots of ancient tombs and stuff like that are covered in warnings.
Well,
you know, they have things on them that look like, don't come in here because you will be tortured by evil spirits if you do. And what do people do? They go right on in.
Yeah.
They're like,
the
that
thing.
Looks so cool.
Here's
our
the thing.
Response to that is, lol's ancient Egypt.
After a few people go in to your nuclear waste site that has been warning that there are evil spirits here, they get sick and die, and then you get the growing folklore that indeed evil spirits live there and we need to stay away.
Well,
again, using ancient Egypt as an example, there are still to this day rumors that going into these ancient tombs of great warning, you know, there are still rumors that that will let evil spirits upon you,
and
people have died.
In my case,
that you
there'll
can
be,
make a case for
there'll
it.
There'll be a pile of bodies.
But you forget several things. I mean, number one, don't people still think Howard Carter was killed by the mummy's curse?
Yeah.
And then number the effects of radiation might be very slow acting. You might have people establish a community before they start getting all these problems.
Yeah, but then that community dies out. And again,
go back to a major city.
You're just trying to emphasize your cruelty.
I'm just saying that if one small portion of humanity in 10,000 years has to die so that the rest of humanity is aware that there in fact is a terrible, terrible thing here that will cause harm due to the stupid decisions of their ancestors. Okay. Rather than how do we figure out a warning that will actually apply to them? I mean, ultimately it's going to be, we don't have any way of knowing, right?
Yeah.
There's no way for us to know. Barring the invention of a time machine.
Yeah.
We cannot tell. So ultimately, and also it's not really going to matter to any of us eventually. I mean, not directly. It really isn't.
You're a terrible person, John.
Yeah.
No,
I am appalled.
I'm not saying we don't have a responsibility for future generations.
Yes.
We certainly do, I believe. However, not only are we not going to know about it, it's not going to matter to us by the time it actually ends up being a problem for them.
Perhaps we should task some I don't know, family or organization or whatever it is to every year go and update in whatever the language is, or every decade or something like that. Go up and update the stones
inherited position to be the keeper of the stones.
And be like, no, for serious, we're like for real.
This will kill you.
Yeah, that's actually something like that is sort of part of the proposal they ended up with. Is the signs include requests for people in the future who come across the signs to make new copies of the signs that will withstand the elements.
Huh.
Yeah, see, I think
so. They're saying, like, if this is hard to read, please make a new copy.
They just need to set up a speaker and a looping MP3 of Slim Whitman singing. And that'll be enough.
Okay.
Oh, hey.
People just like, I do not want to be here. And then they jet.
Here's another idea I thought of.
Instead, better than my idea?
Yeah, it might be a little bit better than your ideas. I wondered if you could take advantage of natural landscapes on the Earth. For example, there are places on the planet Earth that you absolutely do not want to go, and they're bad in really uninteresting ways, like just the center of a desert where there's nothing there and nothing grows and no one settles, and it's just an utter wasteland. I wonder if the best solution would be to do that. Now, I thought that for a moment, and then I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, though. How long does it take a climate to change?
How can you predict what that landscape is going to look like in 10,000 years?
Right. What if it's fertile land in a few thousand years?
You know, I mean, that's a long time. It's a long enough time for things to, especially considering the rate of change, right?
Yeah.
That it's hard to predict what is going to be an arid landscape 10,000 years from now. I mean, it's tricky. So, as it turns out, this is a hard problem.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why it's taken us so long, why we've been running out the clock on the length of time the above ground facilities have been holding on to high level waste while we try to come up with a working solution for the permanent place of that stuff.
Yeah, maybe what we really do need to do is start out some of these like 250-year kind of facilities and sort of leave a memo to the future and be like, hey, we tried.
Yeah. And meanwhile, we're still making this stuff. Sorry. This also is one of the reasons why I really hope that fusion ends up working out somewhere down the line, because it would produce far fewer dangerous byproducts than the fissile version of nuclear power.
Or that any of the technologies to reclaim and repurpose some of the spent nuclear fuel
if it becomes financially feasible. A scalable, financially feasible method, then yes, that would also be a great benefit to humanity. Again, I think nuclear power, the principles are sound. It's just that the reality of what do you do with this nuclear waste is a real problem that we have to figure out how to solve. Barring anyone finding that magic hatch to the core of the Earth, it's going to be one that's going to require some pretty difficult decisions. So it'll be something that, you know, I mean, I expect we'll see more about this within our lifetimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the meantime, get those geological facilities going.
Yeah.
If you can. I mean, that's a lot of political pressure to not do that thing in any given place. But if it's at all, you know, if it's one of those things that can be done, it should be done, because it does look like it's the best option out of all the ones that have been explored so far. So unless someone's come up with something brand new tomorrow, which would be wonderful, I totally agree. If we can get some movement on the geological repository front, that would be awesome. All right, well, that wraps up this discussion about, you know, what do we do about this problem with nuclear waste? And obviously, you know, the answers are tough, but they are ones that we need to tackle. So again, we need to concentrate on these problems. Otherwise, there's not a solution that's going to come up magically. We've got to act on this sort of thing. Anyway, if you guys have suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, you got any ideas for something you definitely want to hear in the future, let us know on Twitter, on Facebook, or on Google+. Our handle at all three is FW Thinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.